Well, I'd like to thank both our speakers very much. I'm going to adopt the shut up and listen strategy outlined by Valerie, so we'll go straight on to questions and comments. It's really less contentious than the first session. Yes.
I was
going
to let you
ask
the comments, but I feel mine in some way maybe just picking up I really enjoyed both of those. It's just, I can't quite believe that I've heard so many other kinds of talks under the guise of, you know, what are the women's stuff now that I'm doing with them. So it's just about maybe that's really refreshing and heartening. But there was just one particular thing that kind of bothered me, Valerie, even though I really was interested in a lot of what you said. And I think I would just sort of get there how you represented a sort of separatism of, you know, like there were these two views of either thing. Men as the enemy and the, kind of their genes and hormones. And I just heard a sort of separatist argument often being reduced.
Well, that was a caricature. I appreciate that was a caricature. I suppose I was introduced it because Dawkins is often seen as being in that camp, and she obviously isn't. And
it's probably. I think it's really important to be precise about that. And I have to say, I've never read any kind of separatist term. I mean, maybe there are some, but I've never read any of the radical feminist conceptual positions that I've read that don't kind of ascribe to a biological determinist view of men or women, but I just see them as being kind of represented in that way so many times, and I just think it's something that it is really important not to fall into. I think that kind of sexism is, in, you know, in my understanding of it, is used as a kind of political strategy, and it certainly doesn't rule out any other kind of strategy, but it certainly isn't about some sort of, you know, biological determinism of men or women going to be violent.
I think there are some who are like that, and I think Dworkin probably came across it herself, and I can't remember what it was, but it was something I read when she was confronting the biological essentialists, and she was opposing herself to that, so she was identified as a group. So I think it is there, but very minor. I mean, any movement you get some people, yeah.
Yes, I'm a separatist, and I've been a separatist since 1977. I'm proud to say that here. A few hours may come out if I'm lucky. They're probably in the room. Now, what that means to me is not that I go into a canyon and don't have anything to do with men who are electricians. Although, some women have done that, and that's perfectly fine. And I support their right to do that, and that seems completely reasonable. But what it means to me is that I have chosen to put my energies into the solution, which is women, rather than into the problem, which is men. And that, for me, has been a very sensible thing to do. It doesn't mean that I don't work strategically with men sometimes. I teach men. I have men PhD students. I encourage their efforts, and so on. But in terms of my personal life, I am certainly a separatist because I actually am putting my energy to women. I love women. Women are the future, and they're everything to me. Right? Now, if anybody else wants to come out as a separatist, that's fine. I just wanted to say that because I hate separatists being attacked, right? I am one. It's dangerous to say so. You know, you probably wouldn't get a job at a university if you dared to say you were a separatist. So it is a dangerous thing to say, but I'd like to say it. And I don't think that men are biologically violent. In fact, I wouldn't have done any of the writing or any of the political work I've done if I ever thought that. So that's clearly an impossibility. And I disagreed with Andrea Dworkin's attack on separatism, and I have read her attack on separatism as believing in biological feminism. I never thought that. I've been in separatist circles all my feminist life, and I never came across a person who thought this. Never, ever. In America, in Britain, in Australia, I never came across one. Okay, thank you.
Valerie, thank you very much for a really interesting talk. And also Finn, very much too. A question I have is both of you, but it comes from something you said, Valerie. You said that when you were looking through feminist political theory, you found a very decreasing analysis of the porn and rape and violence and that kind of thing. I only wanted to ask both Valerie and Finn why you think that might be. Why is feminism looking at these things less, if indeed it is, whether maybe Finn might have different views. So is there really a decreasing analysis of violence in feminism, and if so, why is that?
I think it's partly, as I said, some of it's just there. It's there in the background. It's taken. We've fought that battle. We know this is a serious issue. So when we're talking about getting women represented, we know that that's an interest that they have in having represented. So it is kind of there, but not being discussed. it's also, I think, what's happened within feminism, in that there isn't the mass movement that there was, that feminism in many ways has become institutionalized, has become respectable. In fact, it's harder to get a job in a university if you want to write about sexual violence than it is if you want to talk about the political representation of women or how women behave in the House of Commons. It's more kind of respectable mainstream thing to do. And because of what's happened in the feminist theory, which is the whole postmodern turn and the depoliticising of much feminist political theory, I think. I think what's happened with postmodernism, quite interestingly, is that other subject areas have become more political because they're looking at the power of language and looking at the power of the image, and so film studies and theatre studies have become more political, but political theory has become somehow less political.
I think it is decreasing, and I think that is probably due to the great backlash against feminism that we're seeing, you know, which I understand as, you know, a preemptive strike against women's success before it was won. You know, the gains and the changes that the second wave women's liberation movement made, and the huge force that it was, and I still don't think it's over. I think we've just slowed down a bit, but it's up to us to finish the job. You know, that was so powerful, and I think it's a credit to how powerful all of that was and all the women within it were, that it's been cracked down upon and smashed and attacked as hard as it has been. And thinking about, you know, being within the academy, I remember when I did a women's studies degree, and I remember I actually got the lowest marks. It was quite multidisciplinary, we did from lots of different modules, and I got the lowest marks for my women's studies module. I got higher marks in sociology and politics and law and the other modules because in women's studies I did talk about things like sexual violence, male violence as being the main feature of women's oppression, and I got comments in the margin like, try not to use such emotive language about women's testimony of sexual abuse. So, yeah, just wanted to add that in.
Yeah, thanks for both of those things. One was quite pessimistic view of how much more work we've got to do. One quite optimistic one, that we've actually made a lot of progress, and the kind of behind the scenes has helped us to make that progress. And I suppose I just want to try on a different reading of Morgan's position, which is much more pessimistic and kind of worried almost to the point of terror, really, about where we're at and how little progress we've made and how we're going backwards. I mean, the reason that political theorists aren't talking about her, and the reason that she doesn't get published and discussed and things, is not because she's a bit too radical, but because it really just doesn't suit, you know, the community, patriarchy, to hear the messages that she's giving. And I mean, the way I don't know if this is true, because I don't know anything about her personal life really at all, but I've just been gripped with this idea, really, that she was almost tortured to death by patriarchy. You know, she was kept so marginal, and it was extraordinary. Like, she's really struggled to get her work published, but when she died, immediately there was a rush of obituaries in, you know, all these major places, because everybody knew, you know, the guys knew how much she mattered, but they also were absolutely determined to keep her silent and to rubbish her. So when young women hear about it, the reason they're not, the reason they don't want to read her is to say they're put off is because they've been told to be, they've been told she's this dangerous, awful paragon. And, you know, I had this experience myself. I was teaching philosophy. I was allowed to do it, feminism. I wanted to include all, but I myself didn't read her as closely as I should and didn't take her seriously as a philosopher because I've been sort of brainwashed by this film. So I suppose I see it as the beginning of, you know, the forces of backlash are so powerful, but really we're holding on by a thread to the insights that she had, but we're on the brink of losing this. And I just wondered if you could say anything to kind of cheer me up a bit. Things maybe not being quite that bad.
I gave a pessimistic talk. I mean, I suppose, you know, my hope is bleakly depressing, but has an ounce of positivism in there as well, in that I think things get a lot worse before they get better. And I think if you look through history and political cycles, that's how things go. And, you know, I look forward to the day when women have had enough and we have our revolution.
But also there are young women like Finn who are organising. with a group with nearly 200 people in it, who is going into schools talking to young, what age group you're talking to, about domestic violence. That kind of thing didn't happen before.
Mm-hmm.
That is new, that is progress, that is society. There's lots of people saying we can't go on with this, this is too much. And honestly, that's very
yes,
positive.
There's been an immense lot of changes. I feel like a total pessimist sitting here, but yes, in my day job, I'm a domestic violence worker, prevention worker in schools, and I talk to a lot of children, and I read a lot of research about children and young people's views on violence and violence against women. And, you know, things are changing. Of course they are. Although, having said that, the government's Domestic Violence, Crime and Victims Act hasn't come in. I have it on good authority. It is unlikely to come in at all. And there have been mutterings about how that's to do with increased burdens on legal aid, and as we're funding an unjust and unwanted war and occupation in Iraq, we haven't got the money to spend on legal aid for women to be represented through the courts in the numbers that they would come forward if that act came in, which I think is terrible. And last year there was a survey done by the young women's, well, it's a girls' magazine called Sugar, just in 2005, which found that about 2,000 girls responded. One in six had already been hit by their boyfriends. Over half said they would give a boyfriend another chance if he hit them. And worryingly, a significant proportion said it was acceptable for a boy to force a girl to have sex if he'd spent a lot of money on her or they'd been going out a long time. And also, since the 1980s, the research hasn't really changed. It was done by Zero Tolerance around boys' and girls' attitudes to violence against women. And when you ask, as you say, yes, it has changed, they will say overall things like, yes, violence against women is wrong, or men beating women is wrong, or men forcing women to have sex is wrong, that's rape. But then when debates go into it and other questions are asked in a more open manner, you get to it that they actually think, well, it's not that bad if he forces her to have sex if they are married, or if he has bought her lots of drinks, or if he has bought her jewellery. So, you know, it's, I don't know, I think there is still, you know, a lot of pressure on girls and young women, and I'm not sure. We have come a long way, but nowhere near far enough. But when you start at such a level, yeah. I think, you know, yes, you're always going to get better. But
I think we've got some ammunition now, which we didn't have before.
Absolutely, I agree. Yes, things have changed a lot.
I think the most depressing thing is the internet and what people can find on that. I mean, that's just the most horrendously depressing thing, and the fact that so many people can drift into it, and people who have the most awful fantasies, which before they would have faced down as what nobody else could ever have this awful fantasy, they can now go online and discover that lots of people have that fantasy, and it's perfectly all right. And if you do it, if you act without it, it's even better. I mean, they can find that out in a way that they couldn't, and I find that's, I don't know what the solution to that is.
It really needs its own domain, you know, .porn or something, you know, so that everybody else can just stay away from it.
It's proposed.
I know that it's going to be years before anyone does think of that. I wouldn't advise it.
Yeah. Okay, I've got three questions to go over here, you know, clubs, to be hard to point to, but first one.
This is just before we get into a debate about the .xxx and the way that which that would actually explode probably even further, because it would totally be right. Let's forget about that for a minute. But one thing Alison was talking about sort of made me think that there are these disciplinary boundaries as well about this knowledge that we need to sort of think about as well, because you were talking about looking through politics books, you know, within the discipline of politics. Of course, we're within a politics international relations department here, and I think one of the things that's happened is that a lot of writing is happening in this country about different violences against women, but it's not actually within that context anymore.
Yes,
what's
absolutely
happened is that we've stopped writing so much theory, and what we are doing, what we've been doing a lot of is writing and developing research that's, you know, much more about policy, practice, all those sort of things, feeding those things back, and actually having through that quite a lot of impact on some of these directions that the government have on it. For example, the things that people were talking about, three prostitution. You know, some of us were actually the ones doing the research that fed into, as underpinned the kind of directions that are now taking place. So I think there's a problem that we've, and I think that's what we really need to do now, is to re-engage and try quite a lot more with more theoretical stuff. And I think revisit, I mean, actually to relook at Dworkin is extremely important within that, to bring that back into the fore. So I think we've had quite a long period where what we've done is partly because it became so difficult. We saw the debate that in the first session that it became very difficult to discuss some of those issues. But at the same time, we kind of got on with it and started doing a lot more practically oriented work. So I think that's where a lot of the writing is. So if you look on the social policy or...
Oh, yes, I know. I realise that. I was writing specifically about feminist political theory.
Absolutely.
And I wasn't finding it there.
So it's not that there's not writing.
Yeah, oh, yes, I know. And work is
being
done. Yes, yes.
I suppose we do need to acknowledge that. Because historically, I think we need to think how the arenas have been changing in terms of the work being done.
And we need to, yes, and we need to resist the structures, and that's the problem with things like the RAE and other such awful things that make people go into boxes.
But nonetheless, we have to, I think that's what's so good about discussing issues of Dworkin. I mean, it's horrendous that Dworkin has to desire for us to come and have all these conferences to talk about this. Mm-hmm. And it's just horrendous. But at the same time, we are now re-looking at some of those issues again. And last year, the Women's Studies Conference, there is a European Women's Studies Network, of course, and that also looked specifically at violence against women as it's completed last year. And again, very interesting to see a lot of younger academics coming through who are working on those issues and are really interested in those issues and are writing some really interesting things on that. And again,
you know,
with quite radical
perspectives. What keeps referring here is the cycles of feminist uprising against the oppressive system and then the oppression of that, or the stopping of those cycles. And it's always hard to know where you are in the cycle. But I think some more historical knowledge, not only of those uprisings, but of the ploys that are used for their undoing, is very important to look at. And Mary Daly once referred to in the flush of women's studies, where they were recovering women's history. She said, "Well, it's sort of the kitty litter theory. You know, you keep recovering women's history." And I think that we have to be very conscious that goes on, and really look back at the ways in which, for example, one of the ploys that's been very continuous is that when feminists criticize the system, as someone I know said, women are not allowed to criticize the management. And one of the first, deeper way of response of that system is to heavily resexualize the women. And I think we're seeing that, of course, very vividly right now. But it's also been interesting to see that for American school children, they're being, by way of the history of the women's suffrage movement, seeing a great revival of one particular individual who was very popular with the press in the mid-19th century, Victoria Woodhull, because she was a real sexy feminist and could be represented as being a challenge to those blue noses who were carrying on the burden of the suffrage movement. And so I think that kind of ploy is worth looking at over time and recognizing it would benefit, I think, some of the discussions that one has with young women to have them have a better background on just methods that we're always experiencing, but which are sometimes hard to recognize.
So you're actually suggesting we should be teaching the sexy feminists of the past?
Teaching the ploys highlighted them and put them forward in the same way that the women who, for example, the response to the movement for the Equal Rights Amendment in the United States was to put forward the ideal of the homemaker.
Yeah.
Even though the movement itself to pass such an amendment was largely carried forward by former homemakers, or homemakers at the time. and it and it was it just a way of getting the oppressed to fight each other. So.
Yeah.
There's a question over there.
Yeah, just really to say thanks to the speakers and to come back to the point that Fizz was making about, I don't know if this is deliberate or not, but the link between prostitution and just the view that young people, as it were, as young people and anti-personal violence, teen dating violence and domestic violence, and the fact that both young men and young women both accept and justify male violence against women and their own relationship and an adult relationship. And I think it's about that sense of the male entitlement to women and to women's bodies, which is the argument used to support prostitution and pornography. It's about male entitlement to women, whether you pay for the women, whether you look at it over the internet, as you were saying, or whether it's about young people and saying, young men and women saying, well, in heterosexual relationships, the man has the right to both her body and her integrity, you know, he has the power. And it is worrying about how you challenge that, because you're right, but we've got all these campaigns challenging domestic violence, and now no one's going to say violence is right, but when you get down to it, women are still expected to act in a certain way, prescribed by the male in that relationship. So how do you challenge those, how do you challenge those views? It's so depressing.
Well, I mean, I suppose, it is, but... There is, you know, as you said, there is a lot of work being done, and at least it is happening. You know, there are a lot of boroughs in London, for example, where, you know, there are domestic violence workers going into schools, and we have a lot of resources now which we can use in schools right from primary level with children on. You know, yes, you're not going to go in and start talking to young children about, you know, domestic violence, but you can go in and talk to them about what is a safe relationship, what is respect, you know, what is equality. What I think is really interesting is that's happening in primaries, talk about basically, you know, the social construction of gender, but it's done in a way as what makes a boy, what makes a girl, and then what things do boys do that don't quite fit in that box, and what things do girls do that don't quite fit in that box, and that's how we can see that we're all living in boxes. And you've got primary school children learning about gender as a social construct, which I think is amazing. So, you know, there is a lot of good stuff, and you know, we just need more of it. And yes, you know, we've talked a lot about domestic violence, and unfortunately it seems that, you know, to the government, male violence against women is domestic violence. That's what it is. And great that so much is happening on domestic violence, but it doesn't cover all the other forms, and it never calls it male violence against women. And of course, domestic violence, as we know, is non-gender specific, and there's all these non-gender definitions of domestic violence now. You know, and I think the campaign, the coalition, the End Violence Against Women coalition, headed up by Amnesty and the Women's National Commission, which is actually trying to lobby the government for a combined strategy on violence against women, so we don't get separate reports coming out on rape, separate report on trafficking, separate report on prostitution. We actually have a combined violence against women strategy, which they have in Scotland.
And of course in Scotland you've got an awful lot more women in the parliament, so articulating your view, so you have it on the agenda and have had it for since the parliament started, and going into the parliament, so it's there and more strongly.
And I think I'd just like to say as well that, you know, although we do have to do more writing, we do have to do more research, we do have to keep working, and we do have to as well, you know, get back on the streets, take some direct action, you know, like rip up pornography, turn it over, you know, pick it outside these shops, you know, we need to take our message back out onto the streets, and I'd like to see all of you on the Reclaim the Night March in London this year. You know, it was, like I say, nearly 700 women last year. We put out professional press releases from a PR company to every, you know, to all the newspapers. We got flat notes from everyone, including the Guardian women's page. And so my policy is, well, okay, people take notice when they can't get across London in their cars because they're held up in traffic because of thousands of women marching in the streets against rape. So, you know, we just got to do it.
I was just thinking about this mainstreaming kind of glamorisation of the word pimp.
Yeah.
Which I don't know if I, like, in the Oscars, the big song which they performed was It's Hard Out There for a Pimp.
Yeah.
And pimps become, in our society, this really acceptable word which calls people the pimp. And it seems like our culture's got worse, even though our research has got better. And I know there's a song by a woman called Sarah Jones.
Yeah.
which was
Your Revolution
will not happen between these sides, which was an attack on all these kind of pop songs. But that's the only song I've found like that. And I was wondering, how are there, what ways are there of countering this kind of pop culture movement? So I'm not sure if the research is doing it. And how do you change those social values? Maybe the march, but I was just wondering if you had any other...
No, I would love to. No, I mean, well, I suppose in our society, if men do something, it gets valorised. If men help him, so it gets valorised.
But it didn't before. There seemed to be some social constraints.
Yeah, and prostitution seems to have become more acceptable.
Yes.
There are more men saying they are going to prostitute in our society. But again, part of the backlash, more men feeling threatened by more independent women. It's one of those circular arguments. You can do something that trivialises some women, but then it makes it worse for other women. And one, going back to Christopher Pankhurst, if women have more economic independence, then they are less likely to have to prostitute themselves either in marriage or in a live-in relationship, sorry, either on the streets or in a live-in relationship. They can make choices. They can more easily leave someone who is being violent to them. So economic independence is a part of the equation, but it's not as simple as that, because you get women who are economically independent but they don't leave.
There's been a very good book written recently in the States, Not For Sale. I don't know if you've seen that. There's a lot of young writers in there talking about popular culture, and in fact, you know, the MTV generation, the links between the music industry and the porn industry. That's quite an interesting book, and I think there is sort of stuff coming out about these things now. But yes, as the mainstreaming of pornography and prostitution continues, you know, we will see the glamorisation of pimping going along with that, because it's part of the mainstreaming of these industries and the part of the normalising and, as you say, glamorising of these industries, which has been around for a while. You know, Pretty Woman, Belle de Jour, things like that, lots of things that glamorise, you know, prostitution and men's access to women's bodies. And this is a modern version of that glamorisation. And I brought something I prepared earlier. Mm-hmm. This is a picture of the hip-hop singer Nelly. He sponsors a soft drink called Pimp Juice. Now, there's a lot to be said there as well about representations of black masculinity and how often when you do see pimps, they are represented as black men, for example. And again, there's some interesting articles in this book, Not For Sale, about that. But you can also get T-shirts for men and women, apparently, which say pimp on them. So, positive, intellectual, motivated person, it's supposed to stand for.
Oh.
So, sorry, I'm the voice of doom, aren't I, today?
But sorry, is there a way of encouraging a different culture? So, like, someone like Sarah Jones, who writes a song where that and gets on the radio, and it gets taken off the radio in America, it's obscene.
Mm.
Is there a way of encouraging artists like that? And maybe should we be looking at ways of encouraging different voices into mainstream culture?
All the time. And I think, you know, what we're all trying to do is, well, we're not trying to do, we're just trying to say, look, you know, actually what we're doing is cool. You know, we're the revolutionaries. You know, what's so new and radical and postmodern about, you know, the sale of women's bodies and violence against women? That's been going on since, you know, the dawn of time. You know, we're the new ones. And I think, really, we just have to try and say that. And yes, obviously through popular culture is one way of doing that. I mean, what I would like to really see is a UK version of that book, Not For Sale, with women's voices from this country. You know, if anyone wants to go out and edit one, that'd be great.
Question.
Yeah, it's actually a question to everybody. I'm from Norway, and it's a very, very white society. And in general, extremely afraid of conflict in anything. Or academic debate. The hip hop culture and the trend for glamorization, etc., is not, as far as I experienced, being addressed until a white man, Eminem, came along and did the same thing. And then suddenly it was a huge outcry, and a lot of academics from different fields came together, analyzed the Eminem's text. And made this a debate in the public space. And I just wonder if, you know, if that was very particular to my country, or if we said to be similar here.
No, I think we're racist too. The same here. Yeah, we had a big debate about Eminem's lyrics all written up in, you know, the broadsheets.
Like, whether it was like tolerated because we were not saying anything about black people's culture, or ignored because it's not interesting. That's just me.
I think it suits the state to make racist stereotypes about black people and black masculinity and what that is all about. I think it's a win-win situation for them. You know, they get to oppress women and then say, ooh, look what all those black men do. So, you know, it's a win-win for a racist, misogynist state, isn't it, really? And then, you know, it excuses then a lot of other men as well. And I think it was an article, one of the chapters in Not For Sale, which was talking about how, you know, what that does is let white men off the hook, because it means they can go, they can sing along with the lyrics, they can identify with the men and their problems controlling their women, but then they can go, but at the end of the day, I'm not a black guy, so of course I would never do that, but I'm just getting into it, you know. So, yeah, you know, I think a lot of that goes on here as well. And it is a very important issue, which isn't addressed nowhere near enough. And then in this country we have the big department store Selfridges recently did its Christmas campaign with a black man represented as a pimp, lots of women around him, and, you know, it's constant. And I'm proud that feminists have picked up on this, and that feminists, you know, all throughout the academy and when they started writing, you know, did start to address the issues of race and racism. You know, we're still doing that, and there's still a lot we need to do.
Okay, well, it's 3 o'clock, so we're going to break now for half an hour for tea or coffee, which will be in the common room, and then reconvene at 3:30. And so just say thank you to our two speakers.